Iran once again says its defense program is non-negotiable and that every country has a right to build a strong deterrent force. The British Prime Minister says that French threats over its fishing row with London are completely unjustified as it refuses to rule out triggering a Brexit dispute tool next week. And thousands march in Rome during the G20 summit, calling for action against climate change and fair access to COVID-19 vaccines. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Iran's deputy foreign minister says that no country has a right to talk about Iran's defense capabilities. Ali Bagheri Khani has rejected U.S. attempts to link the Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal with Iran's defense program. Bagheri Khani stated that every country has a right to build strong deterrent force and Iran is entitled to develop its own defense capabilities. He noted that Iran's defensive power is aimed at ensuring national interests and security. Bagheri Khani made the remarks in an interview with Russia Today in response to the host question about certain attempts to link the talks on the 2015 nuclear deal to Iran's missile program. He said that progress in the Vienna talks depends on a strong will to accept the removal of cruel and illegal sanctions imposed on Iran. Political analyst David Yagubian says that U.S. President Joe Biden's administration refuses to show goodwill regarding the revival of the JCPOA.
Well, unfortunately, one of the last remaining tools in the imperial tool bag of the United States is sanctions. And the United States is clearly just addicted to sanctions. Its efforts at occupation, regime change, color revolution, those continued by the Biden administration that were either initiated or perpetuated by the Trump administration. And so this is really all the Biden administration has. And unfortunately, it is refusing to show goodwill on the eve of potential re-engagement in Vienna regarding the JCPOA by issuing yet another round of sanctions, this time against four individuals and two entities related to Iran's UAV program. I agree with Ali Bagheri Khani regarding the necessity for nations to respect other nations and their conventional defensive capabilities. But I do have to say that some nations, based on their historical track record and their lack of aggression, I think have very good reason to be concerned about the military developments in neighboring nations. And just briefly, Iran, having not attacked a foreign country in almost 300 years,
Iran has urged Sweden to review the United Nations Human Rights Council's report about the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iranians' right to health. Secretary General of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, made the call in response to the Swedish foreign minister who criticized Iran's human rights record. The HRC report details how the overcompliance of a Swedish bandage maker with the sanctions has affected Iranian children with EB, an extremely painful and life-threatening skin condition. Iran says that U.S. sanctions violate human rights as they target health care and the welfare of ordinary citizens, especially women and children. Britain says it may trigger a trade dispute rule against France in a deepening row over post-Brexit fishing rights. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that it may trigger dispute resolution measures in the trade and cooperative agreement next week. This will involve convening an arbitration panel and could result in a demand for compensation or suspension of obligations. Johnson has also complained to European Union Chief Ursula von der Leyen that French threats over fishing are completely unjustified and are not compatible with the Brexit deal. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued warnings to another in its waters. Paris said the detained boat lacked proper license and its captain will face trial next August. Thousands march in Rome during the G20 summit, calling for action against climate change and fair access to COVID vaccines. Demonstrators waved flags and chanted "We Rise Up," an apparent warning against G20 leaders. They're demanding that those attending the top officials make headway on tackling global warming. Protest follows calls by the UN Secretary General. Antonio Guterres has urged those attending the summit to show more ambition, take action, and overcome mistrust in order to advance climate goals. Climate change is among issues topping the G20 agenda. Political commentator Ahmed Altuni believes any climate change which does not address capitalism and neoliberalism will not be functional one day.
Any summit that takes place regarding climate change that doesn't address capitalism and neoliberal economics, it can't be taken seriously at all. Because at the end of the day, as long as you can turn water into profit, trees into profit, oil and minerals into profit, you're going to have climate change. We're going to have climate catastrophe, and that's what's taking place right now. So the idea that 20 countries that are hoarding the majority of the world's wealth coming together to try to solve this problem, of course, is going to be laughable. And of course, they can do a lot more. What they can do is they can change completely this economic system and put people, peace, and planet before profit. But none of them are saying, they're talking about ideas that would have been sufficient in the 1980s, and they're trying to apply it now in 2021. So obviously they could do a lot more, but that would mean taking money out of the pockets of the wealthy, and none of them want to talk about that. For us in the Green Party, we believe in a Green New Deal that distributes equitably amongst the workers, that puts people and planet and peace above profit, and thinks more about the long-term sustainability as opposed to just constant unsustainable growth. And that's kind of what the problem is with having these countries present themselves in this way, because they're not saving anything. Perhaps they're saving face, but they're not saving the planet yet. It's just a show.
In France, a yellow vest protested in urban centers and rural roundabouts for a third consecutive week, and that is indicating to many that they are back to being a weekly fixture in the French political scene. Robin Mazzaheri has your story out of Paris.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media. But the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting.
We will be marching every Saturday to demand our human rights and our human dignity. We are here because there is no economic justice in France. France is an oligarchy composed of political elite, union leaders, and high finance. They suck the life and riches out of the real producers of our nation's wealth, the workers.
The yellow vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the yellow vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
I think what you are seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and swept the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Armin Mazzaheri, Paris.
Now, COVID continues to take its toll on Europe, with several countries reporting a surge in infections and related deaths. Russia is bracing for nationwide curbs this week as it reports its highest single-day case tally, over 40,000 infections. The country also logged over 1,100 deaths. Russia's overall death toll is currently the highest in Europe. The UK, meanwhile, has reported 166 fatalities along with 41,000 infections over the past day. More than 140,000 people have died from COVID in the United Kingdom. In Eastern Europe, deaths in Ukraine have been hitting record highs all week. The country logged more than 26,000 new infections and another 541 deaths in the past 24 hours. Thousands of anti-coup protesters across Sudan have taken to the streets demanding civilian rule. Protests turned violent in the capital Khartoum, as well as the city of Omdurman. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue in length with our guests. Here it is. Anti-coup protesters in Sudan have turned a violent protest that is have turned violent. Medics say that security forces have killed at least three protesters in the city of Omdurman. According to the Central Committee of the Sudanese Doctors, armed forces fired live rounds at protesters in Omdurman and other areas of the capital, Khartoum. More than 100 people were wounded in the violence or suffered breathing difficulties due to extensive tear gas inhalation. Sudanese police have denied shooting protesters. They said that one policeman sustained gunshot wounds. Around a dozen protesters have now been killed since the outbreak of anti-coup rallies since Monday. That's when the military detained Sudan's civilian leadership, dissolved the government, and declared a state of emergency. The coup has faced a chorus of international condemnation. Joining us for the program is Lawrence Freeman, African Affairs Analyst from Baltimore, Maryland, and Mr. Netfa Freeman, Organizer of the Pan-African Community Action from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in the U.S. Capitol with you, Mr. Netfa Freeman. When a year ago, when demonstrators poured out on the streets to oust Omar al-Bashir after a very, very long tenure in the country, this is not what they wanted. Tell us your thoughts on the current state of affairs in Sudan.
I think the current state of affairs is very emblematic of what's happening, the destabilization of the continent of Africa and the militarization of the African continent. There are a lot of interests that are angling for what's happening in Sudan, mostly for Africa. It has to deal with oil and gold and the mineral resources of Africa, the militarization of Africa by forces like the European Union, the United States, Israel, the supporting of militias and arming of Africa in Sudan, in other places, has created emboldened military classes that angles for power. And so the fight, struggle for power, but at the same time trying to ensure, the other external forces trying to ensure that their interests are served. And so while the forces that overthrew al-Bashir and wanted to create a civilian government, and this is not the first time that the militarism and militaries have executed a coup in Sudan, those forces want to see, not a military government. And while the rhetoric of the government is to ensure that some civilian thing would be installed, we can see that has to be not trusted because of their attacks on the people who are calling for a reinstallation of the process that they were engaged in.
Thank you, Netfa. And Mr. Lawrence Freeman, welcome to the program. Sir, your initial thoughts on the current state of affairs in Sudan.
Well, to understand what's going on in Sudan today, you actually have to look back over 20 years, two decades of policy in Sudan. What you had over the last 20 years is the isolation of Sudan, then you had the charges of genocide, the blackballing of Sudan. And so the country really never developed. I was in Sudan many, many times on the streets of Omdurman, where the discussions were today, and there was no development policy for Sudan, and there was actually no orientation toward development from Bashir himself. And then you had the separation. And what's happening is that the people in Sudan, about 45 million people, live terribly. And therefore, getting rid of Bashir was not solving the problem, and Prime Minister Hamdok came in, and he came in with similar World Bank IMF policies that conditionalities undermine the economy. In fact, the economy now, according to some reports, is worse than it was under President Bashir. And therefore, the alliance that they formed in this coalition government was never going to work. It's not going to be stable. It doesn't deliver the services and economic improvement of the country. And the United States now is losing all influence, practically, in the Horn of Africa. It has almost no influence in Sudan, and has turned an erstwhile enemy and ally in Ethiopia into an enemy. And so strategically, Russia and China are going to move into this situation. The United States has less of a role to play. No one's going to listen to it on these issues. And my prediction is that there will be continuing demonstrations and instability in Sudan until an actual policy for development, which the West should have done, is actually enacted. And I don't see that thinking going on right now in Sudan or outside of Sudan.
All right, gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us, Lawrence Freeman from Baltimore and Netfa Freeman from Washington, D.C., two Freeman and myself. Not sure what that makes me, but nevertheless, that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Damascus has strongly denounced a Turkish decision to extend Ankara's military presence in Syria. A Syrian foreign ministry source told local media that the Turkish move amounts to military aggression and violates UN resolutions. Source regards Turkey's policy as a threat to regional peace and security. Less than a week after the Turkish parliament voted to extend for two more years the military's mandate to launch cross-border operations in Iraq and Syria. Ankara says its mission is aimed at fighting terrorism, but Damascus has time and again condemned the Turkish presence on its soil and accused Turkey of supporting terrorist groups. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report describes two January 6 protest insiders who claimed they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6th events that turned violent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by William Rivers Pitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Explosive Report Says GOP Congress Members Helped Plan January 6th Capitol Attack. Stay tuned for more. January 6th protest organizers say they participated in dozens of planning meetings with members of Congress and the White House staff, wrote the Rolling Stone headline. The report describes two January 6th protest insiders who claim they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6 events that turned violent. These two January 6 organizers have begun communicating with congressional investigators and sharing new information about what happened when the former president's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, according to Rolling Stone. This is the first report that the committee is hearing major new allegations from potential cooperating witnesses. While there have been prior indications that members of Congress were involved, this is also the first account detailing their purported role and its scope. The two sources also claim they interacted with members of Trump's team, including former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who they describe as having had an opportunity to prevent the violence. If confirmed, this report would put the word bombshell to shame and would also go a long way toward explaining why Trump's congressional allies have been turning themselves inside out trying to change the subject. An unfortunate grain of salt must be taken with this, however. Rolling Stone's journalistic reputation took a hit over its reporting on the University of Virginia rape scandal 7 years ago. Because of this, confirmation by other news outlets is essential. There is good reason to believe the Rolling Stone report is sound. First and foremost, it reveals that these two sources have been actively cooperating with the January 6th Commission, providing specific details on who was involved with which aspects of the insurrection. Such a claim could and likely would be debunked by members of that committee if it weren't accurate. The Rolling Stone report comes in tandem with a damning Washington Post report detailing how space within the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. was used as a war room for efforts to overthrow the 2020 election. They called it the Command Center, reports the Post. A set of rooms and suites in Posh Willard Hotel, a block from the White House, where some of President Donald Trump's most loyal lieutenants were working day and night with one goal in mind: overturning the results of the 2020 election. Their activities included finding and publicizing alleged evidence of fraud, urging members of state legislatures to challenge Biden's victory, and calling on the Trump-supporting public to press Republican officials in key states. Central to this effort was the enormous pressure brought to bear against Vice President Mike Pence to refuse to certify the election results on the same day as the insurrection took place. While Pence wobbled badly under the strain, seeking advice at one point from fellow former Indiana Senator Dan Quayle, he ultimately chose to certify the election results. At the peak of the day's violence, Pence was whisked from the building by the Secret Service as a mob of furious Trump supporters stormed the halls of Capitol demanding his head. The Willard operation was so serious, in fact, that its members brought in a retired Army colonel named Field Waldron, who specialized in psychological operations, to aid in the overall effort. Multiple witnesses are set to testify under subpoena before the committee about what they knew of Puri mediated plans for violence on January 6th and how high up the chain that pre-mediation went. One of them, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who said on his podcast the day before the violence that all hell is going to break loose and tomorrow is game day, is ignoring his subpoena. By a vote of 229 to 202, the House approved a measure holding Bannon in contempt of Congress, and his legal fate now rests in the strangely quiescent hands of Attorney General Merrick Garland. There are many moving pieces to this, but a sense is growing that those involved in planning and executing the attempt overthrow of the election on January 6th may be running out of room to maneuver. Representative Betty Thompson, chair of the January 6th investigation committee, told CBS News, "There is no question the attack that day was premeditated." One wonders if Thompson is among the committee members who have spoken to the sources in the Rolling Stone report. It sure sounds like it. 30 years ago this week, the remnants of Hurricane Grace were engulfed by a powerful nor'easter in the waters off the mid-Atlantic states. The combined system, jostled by a barometric ridge and a cold front, charged north as a subtropical cyclone before becoming a widely atypical hurricane itself. The no-name storm, or the Halloween storm as it came to be called, raged for days and killed 13 people. Not long after it passed, a National Weather Service forecaster named Robert Case and an adventure author named Sebastian Junger gave it a name that stuck: the perfect storm. 30 years later, another perfect storm is brewing over Washington, D.C. If it comes together just so, the obedience minions of Donald Trump, along with Trump himself, could be exposed as active practitioners of treason within the halls of the very government they purported to serve.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio our two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum and Sayyid
Mohsen. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. So recently, in two Friday Juma prayers in Afghanistan, there have been two bomb blasts, you know, terrorist bomb attacks by the suicide bombers. One of them, which took place first, was in Kunduz, and the other one in Bibi Fatima Mosque in Kandahar. You know, up to now, more than 120 people have been killed in these two incidents, and the Daesh terrorist groups, you know, claim the responsibility of these bombings in these two Shia mosques. Before that, we had these suicide bombing in front of the Sayyid al-Shuhada school, the girls' school in Afghanistan. Really a very sad news, and this attacking of the Afghanistan's Shia minority has a long history. Said Murtaza, let's start with you, brother. It seems that whoever is the administration, the Shia minority are under the attack of these groups over there and are the victims, isn't it so?
Well, of course, yes. You know, in the past at least 25 years, the Shiite minorities all over the country have been attacked deliberately and on purpose. Many analysts have brought some justifications. They have mentioned that Shiite minority is the primary target for terrorist groups such as Daesh and previously Taliban themselves.
Yes.
Attacked, you know, carried out such a deadly attacks on Shiite sites. Unfortunately, Shiite minority have not been considered as one important segment of the Afghan society. They have been treated like marginalized people and marginalized groups. Even Shiite political parties have not been given the first primary attention by the ex-government in Afghanistan.
Yes.
So terrorist groups, in order to prove and confirm their strong presence on the ground, they look for a very swift, easy targets.
No.
And Shiite minorities are the one they are after.
Why is it so? Why so swift, you know, and easy to target?
Unfortunately, you know, in order to have a strong presence in the political system in the country, you need to have some representatives. And Shiite minorities, unfortunately, have not had such a tool in order to prove that they have had so far the strong presence.
Yes.
So terrorist groups look for the easy targets, and unfortunately, these mosques, madrasas, schools, any gathering sites belong to Shiite groups have been attacked over the past 25 years.
That's right.
And even the American themselves took many Shiite people as their hostages when they were just carrying out those night attacks across the country. So we can simply see that Shiites have been the primary target for all terrorist groups and the ex-government officials, just to show that there is a kind of absolute majority of the Sunnis government.
That's
and they are not going to consider other minorities as part of the society and the political system.
That's all right. So thank you very much, Said Mohsen. So Said Mohsen, what would be a solution to this problem? I mean, aren't they going to recognize the Shiite groups and the Shiite minority as a legitimate group who are living in Afghanistan for so many years? I think they are called by the name of Hazara?
Well, you know, there are many different races with ethnicities, I mean, living in Afghanistan. Hazaras is one of them. But mostly Shiite, you know, are coming from the Hazara ethnicities.
Yes, that's right. So what would be the solution to this problem, you know? And so many people are killed nowadays. The children, look at the girls, you know, the innocent girls that have been has been killed inside the Shahada school for the bomb attacks, Kunduz and Kandahar, you know, and the media coverage in Afghanistan has always been, you know, on the
biased.
Top. Yeah, the bias, you know. They say nowadays that the Shias have been bombed or this and that. We have never heard that the Sunni gathering is bombed in Afghanistan. You know, it's really strange news. So what's happening, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously we know that in Islam, the enemies always wanted to inject some propagandas, and the takfirism is one of them.
Yes.
Takfirism means like you claim another group which is not same as you, being kafir or disbelievers.
Okay.
And since in Afghanistan, obviously, the religious groups who were in Afghanistan, especially the Talib or Taliban, they belong to the Islamic seminaries of Ahle Sunnah, and not just Ahle Sunnah, because within Ahle Sunnah we have different categories.
Yes.
There are different school of thoughts. One of them, which is the extremist groups, they're known as the Wahhabis and Murtafiris.
Yes.
We can see, like, initially when against Russia, when they came, the Soviet Union, when Taliban entered into the Afghanistan at the time of Ziaul Haq, when he was the chief in Pakistan or the general in Pakistan. At that time, the Islamic seminaries who belonged to the Takfiri school of thought especially Wahhabism or the Saudi, we can say, backed Islamic seminaries, who considered Shias as kafir, they entered the Afghanistan. And they had, obviously, when they entered Afghanistan, they started to root their own ideologies within the Afghan Taliban, the Afghan, we can say, Islamic seminary schools. Even before that, yes, we can see there was killing of Shias, but obviously it was two-way. They used to protect each other because, you know, when you go towards the borderline of the northern area of Pakistan, where it's Peshawar, and then we have the border of Afghanistan, there also we can see there's a dispute between the Shia and Sunni. Mm-hmm. And it was from before. Yes. But obviously this thing has blamed up, and obviously the things has grown. The weapons and the accessories were given to the Taliban.
That's right.
And then obviously Shia got weakened and weakened.
Yes.
And the point which brother has raised, that's true. Like, you know, in order to show your power, you look for the weak ones.
Yes.
And you always beat the weak ones. So when we talk about the solution is obviously we need to change. There must be a change of mentality because, you know, if Taliban claims to follow the Quran, if they claim to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, then obviously even if the minorities, which you think they are non-believers, there is a protection for them in your country. Right. You know, in Islam, we have the rule of jizya.
Yes.
I'm just talking, I'm not saying like the Shias are the kafir or disbelievers. I'm not saying this. I'm talking on the grounds of the Quran, that the Quran has introduced jizya for the non-believers.
Even non-believers they will give, rights, that's right. Okay.
They have the rights, and the ruler of the country should protect them.
Okay.
So this is what we see. Even at the time of the Prophet, when we look at the history, Prophet did not kill the Jews or non-Muslims in Medina. Okay. Yes. When he was in the Mecca, he never, raised his sword against the non-believers. He, with his wordings, has called them towards the true Islam. So, you know, there are the, basically, it depends, and it is depending on their beliefs which they have.
That's right.
So,
but obviously, the story now is different because the Taliban has got the power, you know. The Taliban used to bomb attack the Shia mosque before. Now they have the power, and they see these bomb attacks from the time of ISIS, from the side of ISIS, okay? And really, one of the spokesmen called ISIS, you know, not a threat, but a headache. It means there are so many commonalities and similarities between the two. But I think the Taliban, if they want to have the power in Afghanistan, they have to recognize the Shia's minority as a legitimate group, isn't it?
Well, actually, in order to have stability in the country, Taliban now is in control of the country.
Yes.
They have to consider a lasting, inclusive, and actually political settlement of the issues. Otherwise, this clash will go on for another 20 years, 30 years, because even minority groups such as Shiites have access to all types of weapons. So now it's like Shiites are waiting to see how Taliban are going to rule the country.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is not going to be stopped, and if this is not going to be considered by Taliban as a threat to other minority groups, I think in very near future, we will have some kind of uprising across the country.
That's
so
right.
It is for Taliban to think how they can provide protection to minority groups such as Shiites. So I think the lasting stability of the country all goes back how Taliban is going to form and construct their policies towards and against groups.
And do they believe at all in the official settlement? I mean, like the other countries have, like the parliament or having ministries or something like that?
Well, I've just listened to an interview a couple of days ago. Because many other countries demanded Taliban to form an inclusive government.
Yes.
The response to such an international request, Taliban said, well, we will have a government and we will have members from all ethnicities in our government system. But international community should not ask us for an inclusive government.
Mm-hmm.
So this statement is a very strong statement.
Okay.
It means that they are going to construct a government based on their own ideologies, based on their beliefs, and they are not going to follow modern way of ruling the country. That's like right. Any other parts of the world.
That's all right. And really, it makes more clear the strategic failure of the U.S. because 20 years ago, after these 9/11 attacks in the U.S., they claimed that we want to attack terrorism in Afghanistan and Iraq. So one of their targets was Taliban, for sure. Is it so? So after 20 years, now the Taliban is ruling and Americans. So what does it mean? I don't understand.
Well,
it,
of course, we all know the fact on the ground sometimes looks very much different from the you know, the general picture, the principles.
Yes.
America went into Afghanistan to fight Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Because 9/11 was a strategic event that took place in the recent history of America.
Yes.
So they went there to take out Al-Qaeda. And besides, Taliban were involved.
Yes.
So now after 20 years, America can see that their first target was not achieved.
Mm-hmm.
They lost a lot. They are still losing. No one is going to trust America any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Afghan nation is the biggest loser.
Loser and victim, that's right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's all right. So, Said Mohsen, any point?
Yeah, if I can just add something about the history as well. We should not forget the role of British and America in the Shia killings in Afghanistan or Pakistan or any place in the world. Why? Because we know that the Ali Saud was made by the Britishers. They have backed them up. And what I can remember, like in the initial war against the Soviet Union, these Taliban groups in the Pakistan, obviously, they were also backed up by the Saudi Arabia.
That's all right.
And you know that the Saudi Arabia has a takfiri, like thinking and killing.
Yes.
Even the Al-Qaeda members, which were nominated by the Americans, most of them were the Saudi Arabian nationals. And we know that, obviously, this takfirism, this killing, and the thoughts has come from Saudi Arabia. If I can just refer to the history, we can see, like, in Pakistan, there was a peace until the Taliban was, obviously, their race. And the Sunni used to marry Shia, and the Shia used to marry Sunnis. There are many examples in Pakistan. But since this thing has started, the things of Taliban, the whole situation changed, and now we can see, that the Shias were killed in even in Pakistan by the the Al Qaeda groups or Daesh or even the Pakistani Taliban. Oh. You know, in Pakistan today, we have many people who claim to be the Pakistani Taliban. For example, in Islamabad, there is a mosque whose imam is the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, because now they're in two different groups, like Pakistani Taliban and Afghanistani Taliban. And this guy has given a statement that in the month of Muharram, because Taliban has provided some protection to the processions of the Shias for their own ceremonies, they were against it, the Taliban in Pakistan. Oh. So we can see, like, this takfiri thought, which is backed by the Saudi Arabia, you can see it highly on a high level in Pakistan, and at a low level now when Taliban is in power.
Yes.
That's the only difference, a low level.
Yeah, but they will face many questions and ambiguities now because they've got a power.
Well, let me just
add to
my brother's opinion. You know, Taliban actually didn't fight Soviet Union war in Afghanistan. Some of the Taliban members were called Mujahideens, and they were freedom fighters.
Yes.
But during the Soviet war in Afghanistan, there was no group by the name of Taliban. So Taliban was created around 1994, I think, by the financial help of Saudi Arabia and the logistic help from Pakistan and the American, actually, policy. So all these three countries came together to create a group that can actually protect their benefits and rights.
That's all right.
So Taliban actually didn't have a presence in the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And you do know that the only solution to the current situation in Afghanistan is the recognition of peace agreement among all political national groups in Afghanistan.
That's
Taliban
right.
is in charge, but Taliban knows very well by heart that they cannot rule the country alone. They need to form and reform and restructure their own institutions in order to give a chance to peace to be established.
That's right.
I think Taliban for sure knows that the situation will differ in future.
We will talk more about the Taliban and the Taliban's behavior. Is it really changed? In an upcoming session of the program, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Said Murtaza, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Said Mohsen.
Yeah.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you much for listening to us. This is Real Points. I am Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com /Ian Kanov Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Kanov Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanat.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has moved to repair his damaged personal and political relationship with French President Emmanuel Macron by acknowledging that the announcement of a security and technology pact that blindsided France was a clumsy episode handled with a lack of grace. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Patrick Winter, Angelique Giuseppes, and Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Biden Admits to Macron the U.S. Was Clumsy in AUKUS Submarine Deal. U.S. President Joe Biden has moved to repair his damaged personal and political relationship with French President Emmanuel Macron by acknowledging that the announcement of a security and technology pact that blindsided France was a clumsy episode handled with a lack of grace. The US president and his French counterpart met at France's Vatican embassy in Rome, Italy, on Friday, 29th of October, ahead of the G20 leaders' summit this weekend, for their first in-person discussion since an astonished Emmanuel Macron was left feeling betrayed and humiliated by last September's security deal. As a result of the AUKUS pact between the United States, Australia and Britain, Australia tore up a troubled $66 billion contract signed with France to build six diesel-powered submarines in favor of a deal with the United States for eight nuclear-powered submarines. It was the first time the United States had offered to share its nuclear technology with a third party other than the United Kingdom. Sitting next to Emmanuel Macron before a bilateral meeting, Joe Biden also implied that he thought Australia had already informed France that it was cancelling its submarine contract. The answer is, I think what happened was, to use an English phrase, clumsy. It was not done with a lot of grace, Biden admitted. I was under the impression that France had been informed long before that the French deal was not going through, he said, which suggests either his staff failed to inform him or Australia misled the White House about what it had told the French. There is no suggestion from White House that Emmanuel Macron himself knew the contract had been cancelled, a point that the French have shown in published exchanges with the Australians days before the contract was cancelled. The two leaders met for nearly an hour and a half on Friday at the Villa Bonaparte, the French embassy to the Vatican. A senior US official said that more than half of that time, Emmanuel Macron and Joe Biden were alone. It was a very meaty, substantive, but I would say broad-ranging and strategic conversation, a senior US official said, adding that the leaders spent a fair amount of time talking about the challenge posed by the rise of China. I don't worry at all about instability or drift in the US-France relationship, the official added, saying relations had been given a jolt of energy in the past month. We had some hard conversations back in September and October. I think the conversations heading into November will be exciting and engaging. There's not any sense that there's some kind of fundamental rift in the relationship. Leaders issued an unusually long joint statement after the meeting on Friday, highlighting areas of agreement. President Biden pledged to step up U.S. support for French efforts in the Sahel. The two leaders welcomed the establishment of a bilateral clean energy partnership by the end of the year. They affirmed their faith in NATO and its nuclear deterrent capabilities and robust collaboration in the Indo-Pacific region. Biden called France an extremely valued partner and a power in itself with the same values as the United States. Emmanuel Macron told reporters that the meeting had been helpful with a strong U.S. commitment about European defense, but he said what happened next was important. Trust is like love. Declarations are good, but proof is better, he said. The secretive handling of the submarine deal and the effective elbowing out of France from the Indo-Pacific region was in part driven by US belief that France did not support a real confrontation with China. But the handling of the episode led to soul-searching in Washington and an acceptance that needed to do more than make gestures of reconciliation to President Macron. France regards the new agreement as necessary diplomatic and security recompense, and a successful effort to retrieve something positive from the debris of the cancelled Australian contract, which shook French trust in the Biden administration, symbolized by the temporary recall of the French ambassadors to to both Washington and Canberra. Emmanuel Macron, in common with past French presidents, has long championed a stronger separate European defense identity that he says can be complementary and not duplicatory to NATO. But he has faced resistance from Germany and some Nordic European Union states that fear EU defense will mean losing the protection of the United States within NATO. An implicit Biden endorsement of the Macron project may help ease some of the objections inside the European Union, as well as play well for a U.S. domestic audience keen to reduce the global U.S. military footprint. Macron will develop the theme of a more autonomous European defense project as part of the six-month French presidency starting this January. Biden sees the shift as part of an effort to focus U.S. military resources on competing with the growing military strength of China in the Indo-Pacific region. Before the meeting, an Elysee source said, "It will be an occasion to show that after the AUKUS affair, we have been able to jointly negotiate significant elements of cooperation on key communal issues." The source in the Elysee said the meeting set a clear framework for future French-US relationship and set a very high level of ambition for relations between the European Union and the United States, with a strong emphasis on security and defense. The Elysee source said a key topic would be our common security, namely European defense and transatlantic defense ties. Macron's office stressed that there was no contradiction between European defense and the Atlantic Alliance, NATO. The Macron-Biden reconciliation, prepared in intensive talks over the last month, will help to heal some, but not all, of France's wounds, but still leaves untreated soured relations between France and Australia, including the issue of compensation to France for cancellation of the contract. France's relations with Britain are deteriorating separately across a range of largely Brexit rather than security-related issues. The AUKUS agreement is also facing growing questions in Australia, with some Australian politicians asking why Canberra has abandoned the certainty of purchasing French diesel-powered engines to become involved in buying nuclear-powered submarines that will be subject to an 18-month scoping study followed by a delay of decades.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.